This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Dateline Shaker Heights, Ohio, this afternoon. The President of the United States with his jacket off, shirt sleeves rolled up, talking healthcare again, as he's been doing. It is getting down to the nitty-gritty, everybody. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Scratchpad blog. Host Scott Jagow keeps you updated on business news worth talking about. Available daily at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 23rd of July. Glad you could be with us. We'll get to Cleveland in a minute, but first let me take you back to the beginning of the president's press conference last night.
Before I take your questions, I want to talk for a few minutes about the progress we're making on health insurance reform and where it fits into our broader economic strategy.
Did you catch that? It went by pretty fast. It's not health care reform anymore. It's health insurance reform. Health care we all like, right? Health insurance, it's easier not to love. The president's trip to Cleveland today wasn't so much about health insurance, though, as it was about health payment. He and others point to the Cleveland Clinic as a model for how to get quality care at lower cost. Marketplace's Tamara Keith has more now on how the Cleveland model might be able to translate elsewhere.
When it comes to health care, more isn't necessarily better, but more is exactly what a lot of patients get. More tests, more drugs, more visits with specialists. That's one of the reasons we spend more on healthcare than any other country, but we don't get better results. Many say the Cleveland Clinic proves it doesn't have to be that way.
We can do it because we know that there are places where it's been done.
Dr. David Goodman studies healthcare costs and outcomes at Dartmouth. At the Cleveland Clinic, doctors are paid a salary. He says their income isn't tied to how many procedures and tests they order, so they do fewer.
If many of these high-cost hospitals started practicing like the Cleveland Clinic today, next year they would look like Chrysler. They would be bankrupt.
Goodman says that's because Medicare and insurance companies pay doctors and hospitals on a fee-for-service basis. But that's not the only significant difference. University of Maryland Dr. John Castor says a big part of the clinic's success is its culture. Doctors collaborate. Specialists work as a team, unlike most hospitals, where physicians operate individually.
Transplanting this organization to community hospitals would be very, very difficult. And even to academic medical centers, it's tough.
And putting all this into legislation, that could be even tougher. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
We normally wait until a little bit later in the program to tell you this, but this was a mighty fine day on Wall Street. The Dow hit its best level since November. The NASDAQ is on its longest winning streak since 1992. There were better-than-expected profits at some key companies, better-than-expected home sales figures, too. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more now from our better-than-expected desk in New York.
It may be raining on Wall Street tonight, but Mark Zandi, chief economist at MoodysEconomy.com, says...
The sun is definitely rising. I mean, I don't think it's going to go to high noon anytime soon, but this dark pessimism that has pervaded this economy for so long is now lifting.
Could you be a bit more specific, Mark?
The Great Recession, the worst downturn since the 1930s Depression, is coming to an end.
Okay, that's one man's opinion. What about Peter Morici, the University of Maryland economist who tracks economic indicators like tweeters track their friends on Twitter?
It's the beginning of the recovery. Analysts are uncovering prospects for profits across the board.
And perhaps companies are realizing they laid off too many people. That's the view of Lizanne Saunders, chief investment strategist at Charles Schwab. She says the rising stock market is feeding on itself, sending investors into the second stage of fear.
we know the first stage of fear, which is get me out, things are horrible. The second stage is as the market kind of takes off on the upside, people are then fearful of missing out.
But she does point out that when you hear housing starts or any other economic indicator are better than a year ago, it soon won't mean much because a year ago we were just a month away from the collapse of Lehman Brothers and everything that followed.
We're entering into the part of the cycle now where year-over-year comparisons are going to get easier and easier.
It's nice to be able to look back on the dark times, isn't it? In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
It is my sad job to tell the kids who might be listening that school starts in like 6 weeks. That means back-to-school shopping season is already here, for all intents and purposes. And Walmart is diving right in by beefing up its laptop computer offerings. Marketplace's Rico Galliano explains.
With the economy still a worry, consumers won't be buying as much of, well, anything this back-to-school season. The one exception, according to a National Federation of Retailers survey, electronics. Americans plan to spend 11% more on them than last year. Analyst Stephen Baker of the NPD Group isn't surprised.
PCs have maintained strong unit growth no matter what the overall economy has been. It's something that's a necessity for students.
That's likely why Walmart, which has trailed competitors in the laptop market, has chosen now to launch a media blitz. It's hyping an exclusive compact Presario PC available this Sunday. Price tag, a mere $298. But Baker says the price isn't actually anything new and may not even be what consumers want.
We've seen lots of $299 products. And while the price point is attractive this time of year, a lot of consumers are actually looking to spend a little bit more.
Because many parents want to send their kids to college with the best possible computer. And students who are looking for a low-cost laptop aren't looking for one like Walmart's, at least according to CNET.com editor-at-large Brian Cooley.
Netbooks are the hot thing right now. They're extremely small, lightweight, internet-oriented mini notebooks. This is a full-size notebook computer, not terribly cool.
But analysts agree Walmart's PR campaign is a signal to its competitors that in a laptop market already locked in a price war, some big guns just rolled onto the battlefield. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
As I alluded to, it will be the really happy music when we get there. Details, numbers, you know the rest. Now, here's an opportunity. Clinical trials of a new H1N1 swine flu vaccine are set to start next month, and the government is looking for volunteers. The National Institutes of Health have put the fast track on these tests, trying to beat flu season this fall. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
If you are interested in an H1N1 study, we are not yet recruiting.
That's the message volunteers were getting this morning when they called Group Health Cooperative in Seattle. Group Health was handling a high volume of calls, the message said. Volunteers will be paid, but the amount wasn't made public today. Phones were also ringing off the hook at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. The school's Dr. Karen Kotloff says researchers want to find out as much as they can before flu season really kicks in this winter.
This virus is still circulating in the Northern Hemisphere, which is extremely rare for influenza. And not only that, but in the Southern Hemisphere where there is winter, there's a huge number of cases.
These clinical trials will determine whether the vaccine is safe and whether people should receive one or two doses. One manufacturer has already started administering a swine flu vaccine this week in a separate trial in Australia. Dr. Russell Basser at CSL Biotherapies says his company is confident in the vaccine's safety.
We think it will behave very similarly, if not exactly the same, as the normal influenza vaccines.
Children will eventually be included in the U.S. trials, but only if the early data show it's safe. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Time for a misconception check now. If you think all the hot entrepreneurs out there are 20 to 30 somethings with the next big idea and unlimited energy to get it off the ground, it might be time to readjust that thinking. The average tech company founder is 39 years old. Overall, the over 50 crowd outnumbers the under 25s 2-1. From the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more now on the graying of the entrepreneurial workforce.
What springs to mind when I say the word entrepreneur?
I think we all tend to have this archetype of the entrepreneur stuck in our mind. The Mark Zuckerberg, the Bill Gates, the college dropout who then goes on to make a fortune on a $1 billion company.
Dane Stangler is a researcher with the Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City. He says that's more often the exception to the rule.
Under the radar is the invisible trends of entrepreneurial activity. We've got this aging population. We have lots of entrepreneurs who fall into those older age groups.
People like David House. He's 60 and lives up a dirt road in Aurora, Oregon, in a home he designed himself.
There's 11 tillable. And then back here, we have maybe 6 acres of woods.
House describes himself as a lifelong entrepreneur. He started several computing companies. He ran a medical device company until it hit financial troubles 2 years ago.
When you get to this age, I think it's important to have had the habit of sort of evaluating what have I got that's sort of an opportunity in the making.
Maybe raising veggies on his 20 acres?
It's an excellent way to lose money.
What about the energy research he did back in the 70s?
Some decades ago, I wrote a book about biogas production. This book, amazingly, has turned out to be the most complete reference about that somewhat obscure form of alternative energy. One of my sons then looked on Amazon. He saw the book was selling for $140. So we thought, well, gee, maybe here's an opportunity.
House now has a biofuels consulting business. He just evaluated a project in India. The book's back in print and selling well online. The Kauffman Foundation says entrepreneurs aged 55 to 64 have founded new companies at nearly twice the rate of 20 to 34-year-olds. Of course, not every 60-something is like David House, with a promising green business up their sleeve and the energy and drive to launch it. Benjamin Jones studies aging and entrepreneurship at Northwestern University. He says the young tend to be more willing to take risks and challenge existing paradigms.
With a number of entrepreneurial enterprises, you see young people who have great ideas, they'll be much more open to trying something brand new.
Jones says young innovators have led the way in internet search and social networking. Think Google and Twitter. That's in part because information technology doesn't take a huge amount of upfront knowledge and education to master. But he says that's not the case in advanced fields like biotech, nanotech, and aeronautics. Here, older people have a leg up.
To get to the frontier in those fields where you can have the next big idea requires much more study now than it used to. In a way, what's happening is we're favoring people in their middle age who have experienced enough to get to the knowledge frontier but are still perhaps nimble enough and flexible enough and have the cognitive capacity that gives them an advantage.
A full head of gray hair, in other words, can offer an edge in entrepreneurship. Researcher Dane Stangler says boomers have other advantages as well, cash and contacts.
People in their 50s and 60s, even today with a decline in aggregate wealth, they do have a larger capital cushion. But more than that, you have a much deeper network of people to draw on.
And Stangler says those factors are even more important in this recession. Any venture that's going to make it will need some cash reserves, plus an experienced management team that's been there, done that at least once or twice before. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, when fees give way to free.
Because digital stuff is not only cheap, but getting cheaper, it's tending towards zero. Now, it never quite gets to zero, but it gets so close to zero that you can pretty much ignore it.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shot up 188 points today, 2.1%, closed at 9,069. That is the first time since January 6th the Dow has been above 9,000. The Nasdaq climbed 47 points, nearly 2.5%, finished at 1973. The S&P 500 was up 22.2 1/3%, ended the day at 976. A number of big-name companies came out with good earnings reports today. 3M, the maker of Scotch tape and Post-it notes, rose 7 1/3%. AT&T rang up a gain of 1 2/10% today after beating expectations. eBay stock was bid up 10.5%. Its earnings signaled a potential rebound in internet commerce. Ford, the only big three automaker not to take government bailout money, is still burning through cash, but today it said it's doing so at a much slower rate. Its stock revved up more than 9%. This just in, again, CIT is still in trouble. Shares dropped almost 15% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The University of Michigan releases its final report on consumer sentiment for July. American aviator Amelia Earhart was born on tomorrow's date in 1897. And you've probably heard, some paychecks should get a boost. Federal minimum wage increases to $7.25 an hour. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tomorrow, the federal government launches its Cash for Clunkers program, tax breaks and vouchers for consumers who upgrade to more fuel-efficient cars. It's not just the U.S. government that's bribing drivers into greener ways, though. The Germans have a similar plan. And sure, it'll help clean up the atmosphere, probably. But will it help the economy? Brett Neely reports now from Berlin.
Everyone got something from Germany's Cash for Clunkers program. The government, which is up for re-election in September, could boast about putting more clean cars on the road. The auto companies avoided laying off workers and closing plants. And German consumers got a $3,500 government rebate for buying a new car, foreign or domestic, and junking their old one. New car sales have soared, but with so many Germans ditching their old set of wheels, the program's having some unintended consequences. Clunker carcasses have been streaming into this junkyard on the outskirts of Berlin.
I'd say that today we're seeing 30-35% more car bodies than before the scrapping bonus. Just today, we've got four cars coming in because of the program.
Bruno Machner manages the scrapyard. He makes his business from salvaging spare parts from junked cars and then selling the scrap metal. With nearly 2 million cars flooding into scrapyards like this one, Machner says the profits haven't appeared.
The supply of spare parts has greatly increased because the number of scrapped cars has gone up, and the price of spare parts has also quite naturally dropped.
That's not all. Scrap metal prices have also fallen, partly due to the number of extra cars that have been junked. Scrap metal dealers such as Machner aren't the only people being hurt by the government's scheme. At an empty used car dealership just across the street, salesman Jörg Benne points to rows of unsold cars.
Das ist hier ein Hyundai i10.
With consumers getting paid by the German government to buy new cars, Benne says the used car market has collapsed.
Because this is just for new cars. The used car dealers got hurt.
When he does manage to sell a used car, it's hard to find another used vehicle to replace it on the lot because so many cars are being junked. That's led to some desperate measures.
I can't get any cars in Germany. The customers aren't offering them anymore. They're all getting scrapped. We're having to buy cars in Spain, France, Hungary, Austria. The day before yesterday, I was in Poland and bought cars there.
Economist Uwe Kunert says if the government's goal really was to improve the environment, it made a mistake by focusing the program on new cars.
A 9-year-old car isn't really very old by nowadays standards.
He says many of the cars being scrapped weren't really clunkers. They had good environmental ratings and could have been driven for another 5 or 10 years. Worse still, he says the cars that German consumers are being encouraged to buy need not be more fuel efficient than the cars they junked. This is a requirement of the new U.S. program.
Probably a few people are out there that buy a second or third car that they wouldn't have bought otherwise. But other than that, it's more or less demand that would have popped up next year anyway.
And with next year's customers buying a new car this year, Kunert says car sales will fall dramatically in 2010. In Berlin, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Tens of thousands of people are expected to invade San Diego this week for the pop culture extravaganza known as Comic-Con. It was just a gathering of comic book fans when it started 40 years ago. Now you'll find devotees of graphic novels, television shows, video games, and big-budget motion pictures as well. What you won't find is commentator Gustavo Arellano.
My idea of a vacation isn't quite a no-tell motel bed shared with my two cousins, my best friend, and three of our pals. They, on the other hand, have made the pilgrimage to Comic-Con for the past 5 years, always returning with bags of collectibles worth thousands of dollars and tales of missed romance. What can I say? They're nerds! This year, one of those guys returns on a bittersweet note. I'll call him Senior X. Through hard work and scrupulous savings, Senior X made a small fortune selling his Comic-Con finds. The proceeds afforded him a two-bedroom condo in a nice part of Orange County and steak nights with us boyos. The good life. In addition to what he bought and sold, Singer X maintained a room packed with his treasures. Simpsons statues, X-Men, rare comic books, anime dolls, hundreds of them, arranged with the care of a museum exhibit, a testament to his entrepreneurial wits. 2 years ago, Singer X decided to turn legit. He bought a fast food franchise. I won't name names, but let's just say their toasty sandwiches aren't like torpedoes. His savings went into building the restaurant, paying construction workers, hiring employees. But it opened in 2007, at the start of our Great Recession, and it closed within months. Singer X did everything possible to pay the bills. He rented out the condo, moved in with relatives, got another job, anything to stave off bankruptcy. But it wasn't enough, and the inevitable happened. Singer X had to sell his collection. Its value? Tens of thousands of dollars. It saved my friend, real-life superheroes indeed. It's easy to snicker at Comic-Con attendees, but here's an interesting point. If Senior X hadn't spent so much money on figurines, he probably would have invested all that cash in his failed eatery. Instead, each Bart and Wolverine, Pokemon and vintage Batman turned into fiscal sanity, a fallback against our tough times, even better insurance than the markets or savings. Maybe I should become a pop dweeb after all. Safer than buying a home.
Gustavo Arellano is a staff writer at the OC Weekly. He writes the syndicated column, Ask a Mexican. You can write us anything you like, questions, comments, whatever you like. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There might not be any such thing as a free lunch, but in this digital age, free is becoming much more possible than it used to be. Chris Anderson, the editor of Wired magazine, makes the case that zero as a price is here to stay, with a couple of caveats, too. His new book is called, not surprisingly, Free. Chris, it's good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
How does this work, this free thing?
Well, you know, it's funny. My kids say, you know, Dad, you wrote a book about how stuff can be free on the internet. Why? Isn't that sort of totally obvious that bits can be free? And then my, you know, people my age will say, you wrote a book about how things can be free on the internet. Are you an idiot? Don't you realize there's no such thing as a free lunch? So basically, 20th century free was a trick, right? You know, razors and blades, it's still you paying. 21st century free online, it's based on the underlying economics of digital stuff, which is that they don't really cost much.
Let me see if I can clarify this a little bit. One of your many points in this book is that computing power and bandwidth and the ability to process information are at the heart of what's free here.
It's because digital stuff is not only cheap, but getting cheaper, it's tending towards zero. Now, it never quite gets to zero, but it gets so close to zero that you can pretty much ignore it. This is a unique quality of digital stuff. You know, this has been true for 50 years with processing, but what the internet did is it combined Moore's law of processing with equally powerful laws of storage and bandwidth, creating this kind of triple play of deflationary technologies.
Moore's law, the law that says computing power basically doubles every year and a half, right?
Yeah. Gordon Moore, who first spotted this property of semiconductors, noticed that basically for the same price, you could have twice as many transistors every 18 months or 2 years. Yeah. The economic corollary of that is that a given amount of processing falls in price by half every 18 months to 2 years. What's now clear is that bandwidth is falling in price even faster, as is storage. And what that means is that everything you do online, the podcast that people may be listening to right now, whatever it's costing you to deliver those podcasts today, it'll be 50% as much next year. And I'll drop another 50% the year after that, as long as we can see.
So close to zero, though, isn't really zero. And if you're Google and if you're pushing out 1.5 billion searches a day, even if every one of those extra searches costs 1/1000th of a penny, it still eventually adds up to real money.
It does. And Google spends billions of dollars on massive server farms and things like that. But the question is not how much does it cost to create the factory. The question is how much does it cost per person per page? And can you make more money per person per page than you're spending per person per page? And the basic math is this, that we're getting better at monetizing attention and reputation. These are scarce commodities. There's only 24 hours in the day and we only have two eyes, right? So that's going to continue to be valuable. Whereas information is abundant. It's going to continue to get cheaper because it's digital. So you have these two lines. One goes down, the other one goes up, and there's the model.
Aren't you transferring costs, though, from consumers, right? I don't have to pay anything for Google, to the producers. I mean, they do sort of have to pay.
Well, you're transferring it to somebody. The question is it you who's paying? If it's not you who's paying, then it is effectively free. So sometimes it's advertisers, and that's the basic model. And sometimes it's what we call freemium. This is this what I call the first 21st century business model. And this is where maybe 10% of the people buy the premium service and the 10% subsidize everybody else.
This book has drawn some unwanted attention for some of the journalistic issues that have arisen with it. You have been accused of, and you have said rightly so, lifting passages unattributed from Wikipedia and other published sources. What do you say to that?
Yeah, absolutely. You used passages from Wikipedia, and some of them were not attributed, and they should have been. And, you know, my mistake. You know, those of us who write a lot online are very used to citing stuff with simply a link. You can reference something, all you do is hyperlink it, and attribution is given. We live in a messy world right now. We're trying to figure out how to take these online habits that are valuable and mesh them with these old offline habits that are also valuable while doing justice to all credits involved.
Chris Anderson is the editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. His most recent book is called Free. Chris, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks. It's fun.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a last word on healthcare reform, at least for today. Despite the president's best efforts, change won't happen before Congress takes off for the summertime. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said today the package that's working its way through the Senate will get out of committee by early August, but a full floor debate and vote is going to have to wait until September in that chamber, and it's not faring much better in the House. The relevant committee there, Henry Waxman's Energy and Commerce panel, put off its hearings for a third straight day to allow for some more backroom negotiations. And that is Marketplace this Thursday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 188 points. That's 2.1%, closed back above 9,000 for the first time since January. The Nasdaq gained 47 points, nearly 2.5%. The S&P 500 added 20 points, 2.1%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, demand for nurses may be drying up.
I'm like, what shortage? I can't get a job. That's really the case. I'd cry, but I can't. I just want to laugh about it.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.